John chapter 15, Jesus said, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, and you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers. And the branches are gathered, thrown in the fire, and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another, as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you, that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. These things I command you so that you will love one another. If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecute me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will also keep yours. But all these things they will do to you on account of my name, because they do not know him who sent me. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have been guilty of sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin. Whoever hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works that no one else did, they would not be guilty of sin. But now they have seen and hated both me and my Father. But the word that is written in their law must be fulfilled. They hated me without a cause. But when the Helper comes, whom I will send to you from the Father, the Spirit of truth, who proceeds from the Father, he will bear witness about me. And you also will bear witness, because you have been with me from the beginning. Let's pray. I thank you, God in heaven, for the love that you have shown us. The love that comes from you is perfect, for you are love. Pray that you would cause us today to have your Spirit, and that your Spirit would lead us to love you and have that love come out through us to others. In Jesus' name, amen. So, let's see here. They've come back to Egypt second time. Joseph has invited them to eat, has served them the food, has set them in the order of birth, and has given Benjamin five times as much as everybody else during their meal. At this point, we begin chapter 44. I'm going to read verses 1 through 12 here. Then he commanded, Joseph commanded the steward of his house, fill the men's sack with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest with his money for the grain. And he did as Joseph told him. As soon as morning was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys. They had gone only a short distance from the city. Now Joseph said to his steward, up, follow after the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is it not from this that my Lord drinks, and by this that he practices divination? You have done evil in doing this. When he overtook them, he spoke to them these words. They said to him, why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from you, from your servants, to do such a thing. Behold, the money that we have found in the mouth of our sacks we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Which of your servants is found with it shall die. Whichever is found with it shall die, and we also will be my Lord's servants. He said, let it be as you say. He who is found with it shall be my servant, and the rest of you shall be innocent. Then each man quickly lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack. And he searched beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. So, we have some interesting items here. In verse 1, we see again our reference to sacks and food. We've already talked about that. In this case, as with the first case, Joseph puts the silver that they brought to pay for their grain back into their sacks, and back into each sack. So each person had an individual personal sack here. Also, I think, I didn't make this point before, I kind of like maybe hinted at it or maybe implied it, but the idea that each one of them would have one sack, and that was like all the grain that they came to get. Kind of, if you add in the fact that like Jacob had like an entourage, basically he had servants, he had huge flocks. It seems unlikely one sack of grain was going to be enough for them to take back home. Anyway, so I won't go any more into that. We've already covered that. In verse 2, we're told about an additional item that's put into the sacks this time is rendered here the silver cup. Does anybody have something besides cup in their translation there? I think most of them are pretty uniformly say cup. Cup is a fine translation. More literally, it just means a goblet-shaped item. Something that has a goblet shape to it. So it is used in multiple places elsewhere, and it's used as a cup or a bowl. So and in verse 5 we did read that Joseph, it says his steward says, don't you know this is the cup that he drinks from? He drinks from it and uses it for divination. So I think that's mainly the main reason why most people choose cup as the rendering for this. However, from my research, it was also not uncommon for them to actually have bowls that they drank out of as well. So, you know, whether it's something like a cup with a pedestal or just a cup that sat there, to me the difference between a cup and a bowl is the cup is going to be like a relative to its heights, it's going to have a smaller diameter, so it's going to be more like a cylindrical shape, versus a bowl is sort of short and squatty with a wider mouth. It also is interesting because, like, some of the ideas behind the divination practices of that time would be to that it's I'm not going to get into divination later, but just keep, think about the differences of that word. I don't think it's a major deal, but we'll talk about divination. When we talk about the divination, that'd be interesting to remember back to this. In verses, let's see here. And also in the same verse, when it says it's going to put it in Benjamin's sack, it says he says, put it in the sack of the youngest. The word there is quaton. And so youngest or smallest, it could use either one of those. And it back to our little conversation about grain and sacks and that sort of thing. This is also says that bring it says put back the money they brought for the grain. So the money was for the grain, not for food. Food, grain, different words, different ideas there. So in verse 3, they leave at dawn. In verse 4, Joseph instructs his steward to follow and do three things. Follow, overtake, and say to them. And then so the steward here is just going to say exactly what Joseph told him to say, right? Joseph says to say, you know, why are you repaying evil for good? That's basically. And Joseph, you know, says, tell them this is my cup that I drink and practice divination out of. So this is what Joseph tells the steward to say. The steward does that. And from there, you know, this is kind of where I want to talk about the idea of, let's see here. Nope, this is not the part that I'm about to see. Let's see here. Let me just carry on. So after this, after steward overtakes them, follows the instructions of Joseph, the brothers do three things. They deny the charges. They start giving all these logical reasons why this doesn't make any sense, why they would these charges would be legit. And then they perform an extreme vow in reply to these. I mean, it's pretty extreme. Like, they don't even have a chance. It doesn't appear from the text they have a chance to confer with each other or anything. They're just going to say, no, we didn't do it, and you can kill whoever you find with it. So this is pretty extreme. They're getting charged with this. Accused. They're getting accused of this, right? You know, and so they're reflexively getting defensive. And they're getting very defensive by giving, and they give this extreme vow. And this extreme vow should remind us of the vow that Japheth gave in Judges when he vowed if God would do something, the first person out of his house he would give to the Lord as a sacrifice. And so that's an extreme vow. And I think, you know, so as we think about how we vow things, what we vow, we should be very careful about what we vow, because a vow unto the Lord, or a vow of a believer is unto the Lord, in the sense, all our vows should be to God. There's no one to vow to is bigger than God. So if you say you're going to do something, let your yes be yes and your no be no. In fact, it was interesting because at the grand jury, everybody that came up to talk had to be sworn in or whatever. Nowadays, they do say, do you vow? Then they say, or affirm, because there's some people that don't want to vow because of Jesus saying don't vow. They take that out of context as far as what I can tell. But they changed it where it's now, do you vow or swear or affirm, tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth? They still say, so help you God, though. So I guess they don't know whether it's a capital G or a little G when they say it. But anyway, so they have this extreme vow, and then the steward says, sure, that's what you want. I thought that was kind of interesting. I'm thinking, okay, sounds good to me. Whoever I find it, you know. So then each man lowers his sack. We talked about that already. And there's a search made, found in Benjamin's, and now here we are. So verse 13. I'll just read verse 13 and put it with it. Then the brothers tore their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. So, I mean, I guess technically they could have said, okay, well, there it is. I don't know how it got in his sack, but I guess you get to take him on. We'll see you later. But they didn't. They all loaded back up, and they all went back to the city together. We don't know whether that was their choice or whether the steward said, you guys are all coming with me because of this. We don't know, but that's what happened. So this right here, this section here, I want to talk about, and I call it Joseph's ruse, R-U-S-E. Who knows what a ruse is?
Trick.
Sort of. A ruse, okay? A ruse is it's got several parts to it to make it what it is, and I believe this fits all these parts. A ruse is purposeful and designed. It's something that is thought of ahead of time, and you think, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it. And it's a deception. That's the fundamental purpose of it. Fundamental is probably not the right word. It's the tool of what's being used is a deception. It's a deception to a purpose. Number three, it's used to control a situation until that goal or purpose is achieved. So in a ruse, you're going to carry on with the deception until you get to the end result you're trying to get in by doing it in the first place. And number four, it's typically, and I say typically because I personally would say this needs to be part of it for it to be called a ruse, otherwise it's something else. It's predetermined that in the end, the truth is revealed, and that's how you sort of like a gotcha moment at the end. So it's like built into it that in the end, the way that it works is that the truth gets revealed in the end. Okay, so and because of that, ultimately, it's it generally ruses. Ruses are used for the benefit of the one putting on the ruse, obviously. It seems obvious, but it is. But it also could be used for the benefit of the person inside the ruse. Like, this could be like somebody doing something, and you may, a lot of times we'll use the phrase leading somebody on, and it's actually going to end up being beneficial for even the one that got led on in the middle of the ruse. So, but it doesn't always, sometimes it's just for the benefit of the person put on the ruse. But generally speaking, in a ruse, the way I use the word ruse, it would be that it's not intended necessarily to harm the person who's in the ruse getting deceived, necessarily. But sometimes they do get harmed in it. I do think that in this case, So in this case, Joseph tells his steward, says, go and tell them, right? What's he say? Go ask them a question. Why are you doing this? Why do you repay evil for good? They're not going to know what you're talking about. And when you say this, say, hey, did you not know that my Lord drinks from this and practices divination? So basically, he's going to accuse them of stealing the cup. That's what he's doing. And yet, Joseph knows they didn't steal the cup. The steward may or may not know. He told the steward to put it in there. So the steward knows he didn't steal the cup. So they all know that this is a ruse going on. So they're going to play this thing out, right? Many places call this a test. Joseph is testing his brothers. I think that's okay. It's fine. I'm not against the idea that it's a test. I think it's a ruse to see what they're going to do, see how they're going to react, a ruse to get them back to, okay, test them out, test to see what they're going to do. Now, Personally, I would say, my conscience would be, if I want to perform a ruse, I'm going to not actually verbally speak an untruth if I can help it. I mean, like, that's going to be my goal. Maybe I don't even do it if I can't. But that's my conscience on that. I don't think actually there's any necessarily, so far, they've carefully crafted their words that there's not an actual lie going on so far. So that's, to me, this is what's going on in this section. This is Joseph. He's beginning. He's crafted this little ruse he's going to perpetrate and do. And from there, we're going to see what happens as a result of his ruse. So they come back, and they last thing we read is they return to the city. Now we're going to read 14. Let's see, 14 through 17. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there. They fell before him to the ground. Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination?" And Judah said, "What shall we say to my lord? What shall we speak? Or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my lord's servants, both we and he also, in whose hand the cup has been found." But he, Joseph, said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my servant. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." Okay, so now the ruse is playing out. Judah is the one who, let's see here. Forgot to look and see there. I'm trying to see if, I don't think it says who said the whole thing about whoever's sack us in, let him die, let him be killed. I don't think it says who said that before. I didn't see that. So here we have, it's Judah begins talking, which is interesting because this is like before it would be Reuben usually kind of who was stepping up. Like when they got home from the first grain, it was Reuben who says something. It was Reuben who presents, I think it's Reuben who presents the coat when they come back. It's at least Reuben who, you know, basically is most concerned about what his father's going to say because he's the father's holding him responsible as the eldest, right? It looks like every brother came back this time as well. It doesn't literally list their names literally. So I guess we're not 100% that Reuben was there this time, but whatever the case, Judah now steps up as basically he's going to take responsibility. And if you recall, he took responsibility for Benjamin before they left. So this is pretty appropriate for him to do so. But this is a little character shift in him from the previous things we've been reading about Judah, I would say. However, he does, and they all bow before Joseph, and that, like Dan said, this is a reminiscent to back when the star moon dream and everybody bows down and everybody's like, "We're not gonna bow down for you." And here they are bowing down again. They've done it a couple of times now. They don't realize it, but they've bowed down before Joseph. So Joseph asks, "What have you done?" And he poses this question, "Didn't you know that a man like me can practice divination?" And this is where I want to talk about the divination part of this. Divination. Everybody know what divination is? Huh?
The act of divining.
The act of divining, right. Everybody know what divining is? Is that where you take the little stick and walk around and it goes when you find water? Is that?
Being able to see behind something.
Yeah. Yeah, like it's I didn't look up every single instance, but it's used multiple times within the law in the context of witchcraft and sorcery and other things like that. So it definitely has a dark connotation to it, like a negative connotation to the word. Okay, so that's interesting. So the root word for divination is actually means to hiss or to whisper, as in like a spell, like whisper something. And generally speaking, the main thought behind it is this prognostication. I think that's kind of sort of, you said see behind, and in the sense that maybe like see ahead. Well, the curtain is like we can't see tomorrow, right? So you, in that sense, you're seeing behind the curtain of what's tomorrow going to be like. But prognostication, seeing the future kind of idea. And a secondary idea behind it could be a more general idea of able to learn through experience or learning through observation, being very observant. Somebody, like theoretically, you could use that word in a very, that would be a very broad way to use it. Like he's divining what's going on by his observational skills, so to speak.
He uses that same word that it uses here for divine it with Layton when he says, I've learned by experience that the Lord is with you in all that you do.
Oh, yeah, cool. That's a good, thank you. So, in this case, I think most, I don't know exactly how many, but it says here, indeed divine. He can indeed divine. Well, that's literally just the same word twice in the Hebrew. It's divine. And one of those double usage to like, you know, like make it emphasize that, you know, like really, really do it kind of thing. And these are, the word is a verb, uses the verb here, to divine. So it's something that somebody's doing, it's an action verb. And action word. Now, one thing that happens here in this section is, if you go read the commentators, many of them want to read back into this the righteousness of Joseph. And they don't like to use the word divine, because it's that negative connotation we talked about. And therefore, they say, well, Joseph was so righteous, and therefore he would not have actually practiced divination, especially in the negative sense, like to the other gods or whatever. And there's also some translations that they get so worked up about it that they actually change it, and they say things like, instead of divine, they'll say learn about the future. And that does not carry the same meaning as divine, right? Or one of them actually said, instead of saying, don't you know, a man like me can divine, it says a man like me can discover God's plans, big G God. I mean, that's not what the word divines means, just so you know. I mean, it's not any way limited that way. So be careful about, you know, how you're reading it. I mean, that's why it's good to go back and check it out. But so in verse 5, he told the servant to say, you know, this is a cup. This is the one my master uses to divine. And then here Joseph asks his brothers, but he says, did you not know that a man like me can do this? He doesn't actually say he does it. A man like me, he's referring to his position. You know, he's saying, don't you think that being like high up in Egyptian government, you know, you would think like, you know, that's something that these guys do. They're kind of into that because, you know, but, and I'm sure, I expect all the rest of them were, because it was, you could go to the priest and they could ask them about your future, you know. You could like give them a little money and kind of like buying indulgences. You can just see what the future, they could divine what the future is going to be for you. So, or they put forward, they could, right? And they had the help of the evil spirits as well. But, so all this protecting Joseph is actually, I think, unnecessary if you really read the text correctly. Because Joseph is not saying he does it. He's saying, don't you think, and this is all part of his ruse again, yeah?
It puts it forward as, hey, this thing's missing. Who's got it?
Like, maybe I
you stole it.
No, that didn't literally come out and say it. That's why when you read it, it's like you got to read it carefully. It's like it's real easy to read a bunch into it, is what I'm saying. You got to be real careful not to do that. And that's part of what a ruse is about. It's to make it so ambiguous that you start that the person see you see how they're going to interpret it, right?
What's on the inside.
Exactly. That's what a ruse is. I mean, a lot of times a ruse is used for. Yes, sir.
He also was he married the daughter of the priest's aunt.
He did do that, but I don't know if they knew that or not. Well, his father-in-law might have, right? Probably did. That, yeah. So I appreciate the clean translations where it just says indeed divine. Some of them will literally say divine in it because it's literally the two words. But actually the text is silent as far as like actually saying Joseph did this. But this is back where I talked about the cup and the bowl thing. And it's like, so the practice, the understanding of the practice that best we know back then would be like, the idea is they would look into the whatever the word is, the cup, the bowl, and they were looking at like the reflection and the silver, and that was the idea. They could gaze into it and see into the future. That was the word picture. That was the not the word picture. That was the what's the that was the that's what the idea was, is that they were like visually representing looking into the future. Which is why it seems like, you know, if you're looking into a cup, it's like, you know what I mean? So to me, a bowl kind of fits better for that idea behind, I'm going to put this liquid in there, it might be this concoction, you know, this to put in there, and they're going to look in there, oh, your future, I see your future in there, kind of thing. Anyway, I don't care, you can call it a cup if you want to, or a bowl, either one works. And they did drink out of it, so I'm sure they had cups as well. So anyway. But I wanted to deal with the word divination there because of all that ambiguity by the commentators and different translations and stuff. So he's like, hey, don't you know that men like me can do this? Which also, if the brothers believe it, and they probably would, that's going to make them even more like, oh, I might as well tell them the truth. If he can tell, he can divine the future. I mean, he knew the cup was there and we didn't put it there. And that's the other thing. I think I'll talk about this later, maybe. But it's like, how'd that cup get there? Did you put it there? No. You put it there? No. It's like, because later I think it's like, I think it was before. It's like, the gods are against us. Remember that? The first time they found the cup? The gods are against us. It was the God then. It wasn't plural. It was singular because of the verb. But, you know, this idea that it's like the whole... Can't nothing go right, Murphy's Law, you know, that kind of idea. All right. So Judah in verse 16, we're in verse 16 now. Judah then basically, he begs for mercy. Joseph is again, Judah finds himself in the same position that Jacob was in. Jacob had no other choices but to let Benjamin go. Are they going to die of starvation? And now Judah here, he's like, I don't have nothing. I have no leverage. I have nothing to offer you. You know, I have nothing. There's the cup. You know, we had it in our possession. I mean, what am I supposed to say? I mean, I can tell you that I didn't do it, but I'm only one witness, right? So he begs for mercy, and he has no answer. And in doing so, he speaks about the. He claims this is divine justice for the past. He says, yeah, how can we clarify? God has found out the guilt of your servants. God has found out the guilt of your servants. So I thought that was really interesting. Has anybody got something besides guilt? Somebody got iniquity?
Yes.
Yeah, you got some iniquity? So they're very similar. I think iniquity is probably the closer of the two choices there. The word iniquity comes from the root word that means, let's see here, to bend or to be bent. And everybody who's read the space trilogies would recognize the idea there, the bent one kind of thing going on. So he's saying God has found out our bentness, our crookedness, so to speak. In fact, there's another word it's very, very close, like one little character difference in the Hebrew, and it actually means crooked. So like the two words are like sisters, basically. One of them is to be bent, and one of them means crooked. So not as in not our not straightness. It's a kind of rough way to say it, but that's what they're saying. God has found out our not straight, that we weren't straight. And here, and I always feel like I always want to point this out. He says Ha Elohim, which means the God. And then when it says found out, that's the verb again. That's your singular verb. So he is saying the God, like the God above all gods, has found out, which is kind of interesting. I mean, I don't want to put too much on it because we, like, did he think God didn't know and he just recently found out? I don't know. It's not necessarily in there, but. Yeah, this is where I have my little note about the presence of this cup showing up kind of could seem supernatural to them. And so it kind of go along with this God's after us idea. And, you know, God being after you, if you're a believer, that's his way of chastising you, right? Not letting you go. So that's not a bad thing for a believer. We want God to be after us all the time. Never leave us, right? Be after us. We should. So anyway, his resulting he says, we are your slaves. So here now, Judah decided to go full bore and say, look, we're all yours. Because literally, Joseph can do whatever he wants to. They have no recourses. They have no way to defend themselves. They're in a foreign country without any allies, without anybody they know, most likely. And they're in the presence, in the house, of the second most powerful person in the country who could just do whatever he wants to. So he's like, basically, they are his slaves. He's just saying, okay, we're your slaves. And then Joseph says, no, 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 no. I think this is interesting because it's like, almost he like takes it and he goes, oh, no, no, you can go home. I'll just keep Benjamin. Again, this is like the peak of the ruse here. What's going to happen? This is like that last pressure point is going to push on him. And we're going to see what happens next. So 18 through 31. I'm not going to read all this because it's basically a recounting of what we read in the last couple of chapters. I will say that there's no deception in here by Judah. He doesn't try to water it down. It seems to be straight up what we had that happened before. But he's going to now beg to be heard by Joseph and start talking about, hey, you know, you asked about this father we had, and he's going to say, basically, if you don't let Benjamin go back home, you will be, in effect, killing our father. And so he recounts that history, but this section is We're gonna take this section and talk about it add it to the next section. But one of the things that we have a lot of this is one of the sections this is one of the places in Scripture where we have Benjamin the character the man the young man here he's young we have him talked about almost the most in one place. He's talked about throughout the whole thing. And so I couldn't resist thinking about, can we get any information here about, to get us any more clues about Benjamin's age? Like, how really was it here? Because we don't really have a firm point in the text that tells us Benjamin's age. We have that marker about, you know, when he was born, but there's no time references there as well. So I had a little thing here I was going to show you. If I could find it, I should be able to. It should be right here. Little timeline things, sort of. So this might be a little bit familiar to you. I think I showed you something similar before. But last time I made this little timeline, I actually had this section really big. And then I had these two kind of over here squished up because we were talking about all that stuff that was going on in that time, like the visit, the traveling from Canaan, possibly seeing Esau, their time in Shechem, the whole Dinah incident. Then they go into Bethel. And then they're on their way to Hebron when they go through Bethlehem, and Benjamin's born, and Rachel dies, and then they live in Hebron. And then you had chronologically in the text, you had Joseph begins his dreams, and then later on chronologically in the text, we're talking about Isaac dying. And what I wanted to do this time was put these time frames in a more appropriate, like, to scale. So, like, this is leaving Hebron. No, it's not. This is leaving Hebron. This is Joseph being born. So Joseph's our main character right now, right? So Joseph being born starts our timeline. And then, so we know Joseph, we have definitive textual telling us, like, when he was born. He was born 6 years before they left from Hebron. And then down here, we have the 17-year-old thing that happens. We know he was 17 when he had his dreams, and presumably not long after that's when he's sold into slavery. And we also know that he's 39 years old when the brothers come and Jacob comes back within a year, you know, 39-ish, the second trip. And then if they go straight home and get Jacob and bring him straight back within a year or so, it's kind of real close. We know... These are set because we know when Jacob dies, we know how old Joseph is when Jacob dies, and we can figure all these back. And we know that Joseph is 29 when Isaac dies because we know the age of Isaac and we know the age of Jacob, and we can triangulate all this together. So these become fixed points along the way. So we know that Joseph is 17, and we know that he's 39 whenever the brothers come. So we know that between those, we have 22 years. We also know that from here to here was only 11 years. So there's actually a whole lot more, twice as much time between when this happens and this happens than there is between them when they leave Hebron and then Joseph is 17. The question is, you know, and you can have, if you just take it chronologically, like in the text, boom, 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 then you're going to have everything from A to G. That was that list I gave you down here. I show it to you one more time. There's everything from A to G happening in that first 11 years, which it's not that it's impossible, but if that happens, then that means that Bethlehem and Rachel dying and Benjamin being born had to happen before here. So let's just say it happened here. Well, that means that Benjamin is like 22, 23 years old at this point because we know how long this time frame was. However, if we don't necessitate that the text was giving in a chronological manner, but it was just given, there were chronological sections, then there's a story about something that happened, and that Joseph's story actually started sometime in between all this going on, potentially. you could push it back. Then you could push. You could push the whole. They're heading. They're if. They could be heading to Hebron because Isaac's died, and so that they're because we know that Jacob is there in Hebron after Isaac dies to bury him. So then Joseph, this whole Joseph thing, could, I mean, not the Joseph thing, Benjamin could be born anytime in here. It leaves the possibility of a time after here, if you're willing to put Joseph's events starting within all those different events down there. So if that's the case, then theoretically, that also assumes that the trip to Hebron, which was when Rachel dies, they're on their way to Hebron, that was to get there before Isaac died. If that's the case, then it would be sometime, it could be as late as here, and Benjamin could be as young as 11 years old when he goes to Egypt in that case. So I'm not saying one's right and one's not right or whatever. I'm just trying to give us some more parameters for the probable ages of Benjamin at this time that we're talking about him today. And so, because there's different ways, I mean, whether C's on this side or that side, or, you know, you could play around with it. But it helped me to draw these in the correct proportions. Because when you make, like before, I had the 11 years being this wide and the 22 this wide, it messes my brain up, because there's a lot of time after that. And all that stuff had to happen, you know, whatever. So the point here, there are some clues. There are some clues here that are interesting to think about with Benjamin, because in verse 2, it says that, I don't need that anymore, do you? I don't think. That it describes him as the child, hang on just a second. The child of Jacob's old age. Now that doesn't really help us with Benjamin's age, because just because it says he's a child of his old age, just means that he was born when Jacob was old. And we know that Joseph was born. How old was Jacob when Joseph was born? Y'all remember? He was like 90 when Joseph was born. So Benjamin was born a good bit after that, so he's significant. He's definitely in his older age when Benjamin was born. So then, multiple times through this chapter, and this is why the whole thing about how old is Benjamin, it's going to talk about Benjamin, and it's going to depend on your translation which word that they use for Benjamin, whether they use the term, let's see here, boy or young man or lad, I think was in some of them, even some of the more Englishy ones, lad. And so if you look that word up, it's not very helpful, honestly. The word is Na'ar, I guess how you say that. And so when it says the boy or the young man, it would be ha-na'ar. And it basically, the lexicon says infancy to adolescence, which is, I mean, I guess if you go with that strict definition, 22 seems to be out of adolescence a good bit. Unless we're going to go with the whole thing, they lived longer, so their adolescence was longer, they didn't mature to their elders, they were still considered young boys and lads at 22. I'm open to that. I'm not going to have an answer for y'all. This is just for fun, just to think about it. But there are things in here that are interesting. So, but the difficulty is that if you go outside of this account in Genesis and where that word keeps getting used throughout the Old Testament, it's used for It's used for like servants who have significant authority and significant responsibility, not authority, responsibilities. So seems hard for that to be a boy. But in some cases, it could be a boy in the context. So it becomes very context-specific. I don't know. So it seems like to me the word is very broad, how it's used. So it doesn't help us in narrowing down whether Benjamin was 11 or 22 or whatever. However, there's one interesting verse in verse 20 where it talks about child of his old age. But what's interesting about it to me is if you look at the interlinear, there are, you know, you got the Hebrew letters, but they also, and they don't have punctuation per se, but it appears to me that they have these little scribble marks that are supposed to like help you understand the flow of the, like we would use punctuations. Because I think, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think they're scribble marks that would have been part of the text. And actually, so, like, when you read that verse, it says, Father, it has this little mark, and it says, an old man. It has another little mark, and it says, and a child of his old age, another little mark. And then it says, it has one word, and the one word there is rendered young. And it has another little mark. It's almost like how we use commas to say, the wagon, the red one, was going down the road fast, like really fast. Where we just sort of describing back what we're talking about. That's the way it gave me a feel. I could be wrong about that though, because I'm not trying to push this too extreme. But it says his father, an old man, and then it says the child, young. So, not that Benjamin was like a little child at this point. I'm not saying that, but. It's interesting that they use a descriptor right here of Benjamin, and the descriptor is the word, a different word, not this the boy word. It's the word katan, or quaton, I think. And it means small or the least. So, again, I'm like, well, does that just mean he's the shortest of all of them? I mean, he literally could be the smallest. Or does that mean he's the least significant of all of them because he's the youngest? I'm not sure it helped us a lot either. But it's interesting that the writer chose to put a descriptor of Benjamin in right there. That's all I'm saying. Because there's lots of different things we could bring up about that. We've already been through those about the timelines and stuff. But this word right here, this used, would be a specific descriptor of Benjamin. There's no other person that's going to be talking about. It's not a general use word in the terms of like, well, it's a general use word, but it means the least or small. It means least or small. So the root word for it is diminutive, like tiny, like small. So, no, it's not sure if it's a reference to his physical characteristics or his age. There. So, anyway, as you think about, as you consider, you can like ponder that as well. We continue. Verse 32 says, "For your servant became," this is Judah talking still, "for your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back to his brothers. For how can I go back with his brothers? For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father." So, Judah here reveals the guarantee he gave. We don't know of any reason why Joseph would know this before now, but Judah reveals the guarantee that he has made to his father for the safety, for the protection of Benjamin. He asked to stay as a slave instead of Benjamin. No offer for the rest of them this time, right? Just, hey, I'll take it all. I'm taking it all, the responsibility. I'll take it all myself. And he shows concern for Jacob. He shows that he's more concerned about his father than himself here. He's more concerned about it. You know, we're not really told what's exactly going on in the minds of Jacob and Joseph right here. We don't know. We don't really even know if Joseph... We know that Judah was the one who said, hey, let's sell him as a slave. Let's don't kill him. Let's make some money. Let's sell him as a slave. We don't know a lot of things about that, though. We don't know if Joseph heard that or not. We don't know that Joseph knows that or not. I don't think he ever mentions it. I read the next chapter and stuff. I don't remember seeing he ever mentions that. We don't really even know how Judah said it. We don't know if he said it out of mouth. We presume there's malice there in Judah's part at that point in his life. He hates Joseph too. But it's interesting that he didn't hate him enough to kill him, but he didn't. Okay, anyway, we've already gone through all that. So there's a lot we don't know. However, so what we have here now is Judah's changing places with Joseph in a sense. Before, Judah didn't want Joseph around. Presumably, Judah was one of the brothers who hated Joseph. And Judah was fine to sell him off into slavery and be rid of him. Now, Judah is saying, nope, I'll be the slave. I will take the spot that I was willing to put Joseph into. Here's the kicker, though. For the sake of the other child of Rachel. This isn't for the sake of Simeon or Levi, his blood brothers, right? No, he's now willing to do this for the sake of the other chosen child, the other loved child of the loved wife. That makes it even more significant. So the question is, and we don't know the answer to this because we're not told, but did they not hate Benjamin like they hated Joseph? If they didn't, why? Did Jacob reform his way he was doing things within the family? Did he do it differently? Or is it just a change of heart within Judah? We don't even know about the other brothers, by the way. They could have still hated Benjamin. We don't know. But we know that Judah here, is Judah just simply still being pragmatic? Was he being pragmatic like he was, like, hey, let's sell him and get some money? That was pragmatic. And he's saying, look, we're going to die if we don't take him. I guess I'll just be responsible for him. Yeah, I don't particularly hear that, but I mean, we're not exactly told that. So it's very, very interesting. But what we do know is, we do know that basically in this situation, Judah is willing to lay down his life for the life of his brother, Benjamin. And that's one of the reasons why it made me think of Jesus in his parable of the vine. When he says that there's no greater love a man can show, that he lay down his life for that of his friends. And so I see here I would like to see Judah showing love to Benjamin and to Jacob. Basically, showing love to others over himself. And if that's what's going on, then I believe this can be a great example for putting ourselves aside and putting the needs of others ahead of ourselves and loving others like we love ourselves.